Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine this scenario for a moment. Someone you know, maybe a loved one, receives the truly devastating diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. It's a progressive neurodegenerative disease. Then, after genetic testing for a really crucial gene, SOD1, you're told the results are, well, of uncertain significance.
Right, that ambiguity, that not knowing. It's incredibly difficult.
Exactly. It leaves individuals, their families, just in this agonizing limbo. It delays a definitive diagnosis, and maybe most critically, it delays access to potentially life-changing targeted therapies. It's a profound problem.
A huge real-world problem.
But what if, this is the exciting part, what if scientists could proactively map almost every single possible genetic change in a gene like SOD1? You know, before it's even seen in a patient. How could a map like that, such a comprehensive resource, not only clear up those baffling uncertain diagnoses, but also maybe reveal some really deep insights into how the disease actually works?
That's the core question they tackled.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're about to explore how a team of brilliant minds really tackled this challenge head on. So today we want to celebrate the groundbreaking work of Anna Aksakova, Megan Ding, Atina G. Coate, and their colleagues. Folks like Peter M. Anderson, Warren Van Lagerenberg, and Frederick P. Roth, too.
A really collaborative effort.
Definitely.
Yeah.
From institutions like the University of Toronto, University of Pittsburgh, Sinai Health, their team has truly pushed forward our understanding of these SOD1 missense variants and, you know, their complex impact on ALS. So just to make sure we're all grounded, let's quickly recap ALS. It's this progressive neurodegenerative disease.
Uh-huh.
It relentlessly attacks the motor neurons. Those are the nerve cells controlling voluntary muscle movement.
Right, the ones that let you walk, talk, breathe.
Precisely. And this attack leads to muscle weakness, then paralysis, and tragically, eventually death. It affects quite a few people. Lifetime prevalence is about 1 in 300. It touches a lot of families globally.
And it's critical to understand that a significant subtype of ALS is directly linked to variations or changes in the superoxide dismutase 1 gene.
SOD1.
Yeah. This gene is vital. It encodes an enzyme, and that enzyme's job is basically scavenging harmful free radicals in our bodies, protecting cells from damage.
Like a cellular cleanup crew.
Sort of, yeah. And when this enzyme doesn't work right because of a gene variation, it can lead to neurodegeneration. We see SOD1 variations in, well, quite a range, maybe 9% to 23% of familial ALS cases.
So where there's a family history.
Exactly. And also in 2% to 5% of sporadic cases, where it seems to appear out of the blue.
And given how serious ALS is, the diagnostic journey itself can be incredibly frustrating. You mentioned the delay.
Yeah, diagnosis often takes a year on average after symptoms even start. That's a long time when dealing with something this progressive.
And even with genetic testing, we hit this major roadblock we talked about, that 26% figure. A quarter of reported SOD1 missense variants in databases like ClinVar are VUSs, variants of uncertain significance.
It sounds so unhelpful.
It is. It means there's no clear yes or no for doctors and patients. It's just a massive barrier to getting a definitive diagnosis and, crucially, accessing those timely targeted therapies that might actually make a difference.
Exactly right. And the tools we've had to clarify these VUSs, honestly, they've been pretty inadequate. Small-scale functional assays exist, sure, but they're often reactive.
Meaning they only test a variant after it shows up in a patient.
Precisely. And they're incredibly resource-intensive. It's like putting out tiny fires one by one after they've already started.
Not very efficient.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And computational prediction tools, well, they're getting better, but they still only provide supporting evidence under current clinical guidelines. They haven't really been robustly tested and validated specifically for SOD1.
So it leaves this big question hanging.
Yeah. How can we get beyond these reactive, sort of limited approaches? How can we proactively generate clear, strong, functional evidence for these VUSs, get answers to patients faster, maybe even before the disease really takes hold?
That's the challenge they set out to solve. And to tackle this huge VUS problem, these researchers turned to something really innovative, proactive, and just large scale, massively multiplexed cell-based assays.
Multiplexed meaning testing many things at once.
Exactly. Instead of testing genetic changes, one painstaking variant at a time, imagine testing thousands, maybe tens of thousands, all simultaneously. It's a completely different scale.
Okay, so how did they actually do that? What were the assays?
Their method was pretty clever. Using two main high-throughput assays, each designed to look at a different but equally critical aspect of SOD1 function.
Okay.
First, they built an enzymatic activity map. For this, they used a humanized yeast model.
Yeast? Why yeast?
Well, yeast cells normally have their own SOD1 enzyme, but the researchers engineered these yeasts to lack their native SOD1. Without it, the yeast really struggle, especially under heat stress. They have growth defects.
Okay, so they're vulnerable.
Right. Then they introduced different human SOD1 variants into these yeast cells. By seeing which variants restored normal growth under stress, they could measure which ones retained their enzymatic function, their core job.
Got it. So growth equals good enzyme activity.
Basically, yes. Then second, they developed something called VMPSEC, that's variant abundance by massively parallel sequencing, in human HEK293T cells. This created a protein abundance map.
VMPSEC, okay, in human cells this time.
Correct. Here, the different SOD1 variants were fused to GFP, green fluorescent protein. You can think of GFP like a tiny light bulb attached to the SOD1 protein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a SOD1 variant caused the protein to misfold or become unstable, the cell would likely degrade it.
Get rid of the faulty protein.
Exactly. And if the SOD1 protein gets degraded, the GFP light bulb goes with it, right? So the GFP signal goes down. This assay essentially measures how much of the variant protein is actually present and stable inside the cell.
So one assay for activity, one for how much protein is there. That's clever.
It is. And what's truly impressive is the scale and the precision they achieved. They used a sophisticated tile-seq framework combined with something called duplex sequencing.
Duplex sequencing. That sounds advanced. What's the key benefit there?
It's incredibly powerful for accuracy. Instead of just sequencing one strand of DNA, duplex sequencing reads both strands independently and compares them.
Ah, like double-checking your work.
Exactly. By doing this, they can spot and eliminate errors that might just be artifacts of the sequencing process itself. It means they can detect even really rare mutations with amazing accuracy and know they're real.
Okay. That level of rigor is essential when you're dealing with so many variants.
Absolutely. Using this, they measured the functional impact of around 86% of all possible SOD1 misvariants. That's just an astounding number.
Oh, wow. Almost all of them.
Yeah. And each variant got a score, carefully calibrated. Nonsense variants, the ones that totally break the protein, were set to 0.
Yeah.
Synonymous variants, the ones that don't change the protein sequence, were set to 1.
So a clear scale from non-functional to normal.
Right, making everything comparable.
But they didn't stop at just the high-throughput assays, did they?
No. They went deeper. They used molecular dynamics, or MD, simulations for specific interesting variants.
MD simulations. Like computer models. Exactly. Sure. These simulations let them visualize, right down at the atomic level, how tiny amino acid changes could alter the protein's structure, and importantly, its movement. Imagine watching the protein sort of wiggle and fold, and seeing how one swap changes its flexibility or how it grabs onto other molecules.
That provides incredible detail.
Phenomenal mechanistic insights. And crucially, to make sure these maps weren't just, you know, interesting lab results, they benchmarked everything. They compared their findings against population databases like NOMED.
Which tells you about variation in healthy people.
Correct. And against clinical data from actual ALS patients.
Yep.
Connecting the lab bench to the clinic.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because these maps, they didn't just give a little bit of info. They provided this wealth of data clearly showing which variants messed up enzyme activity, which messed up protein abundance, or sometimes both.
It's like getting two different diagnostic tests for each variant.
Precisely, like a high-resolution picture of how these tiny genetic changes impact the protein's health.
And what's truly groundbreaking, I think, is how these maps didn't just label variants bad or okay, they started to reveal entirely different ways the protein could fail, different pathways to disease.
How so?
Well, they categorized the variants into four main groups, or quadrants. About 12% were damaging in both assays, activity, and abundance. Low activity, low protein levels, makes sense.
Okay, double trouble.
Right. Then 54% were neutral in both. Probably benign.
The harmless ones.
Presumably. But then it gets really insightful. 13% were damaging only in the activity assay. They had normal protein levels, but the protein that was there just didn't work properly, maybe affecting those metal binding sites, for instance.
Ah, so the protein's present but functionally impaired.
Exactly. And then another 21% were damaging only in abundance. These variants might have normal activity if the protein is present, but something about the change makes the protein unstable, likely causing it to misfold and get cleared out by the cell.
So the protein disappears before it can do its job.
Precisely. This really changes how we think about SOD1 pathology. It's not one single problem. We can start to pinpoint the specific molecular vulnerability for a given variant.
That is a huge step. And you said the maps also reinforce known biology.
They did. For instance, residues buried deep inside the protein, the ones crucial for stability, and proper folding changes there tended to be damaging in both maps. That makes sense.
Structure affects everything.
Right. But interestingly, variants impacting the metal binding sites, those spots for copper and zinc, they showed severe defects mainly in the activity map.
Because that's where the chemistry happens.
Correct. Whereas changes to the protein's core structure often showed strong effects in the abundance map, likely causing instability.
Why is it so crucial to understand these different failure modes? What does that tell us about, say, potential treatments?
That's a critical point. Understanding these distinct ways the protein can fail, losing activity versus losing stability, is absolutely vital. It means a single fix might not work for everyone with SOD1 ALS.
Right. It's not one size fits all.
Not at all. If a variant primarily kills activity, maybe you need drugs that boost enzyme function or help with metal binding. But if it mainly causes instability and degradation, then therapy is aimed at stabilizing the protein, or maybe helping the cell clear out misfolded junk might be the better approach.
That's real personalized medicine starting to take shape.
It is. And those MD simulations you mentioned, they gave these incredible atomic level mechanistic breakthroughs.
What did they reveal?
They uncovered some subtle but really critical mechanisms. For example, they looked at specific residues like azin-87 and GLE128. These aren't directly in the enzyme's active site, but the simulations showed they were essential for enzymatic function anyway. Well, take the PAZN87LI's variant. The simulation showed that this single change disrupted a crucial salt bridge, like a tiny chemical bond with another residue, aspen-25. This messed up a region called the electrostatic loop, which is vital for the protein structure and how it interacts with those metals.
So a seemingly small change has knock-on effects.
Big time. It hindered the enzyme's ability to bind zinc and copper properly. It shows how even changes outside the direct business end of the protein can cripple its function without necessarily making the protein disappear entirely. A vivid picture of compromised function.
And it's fascinating detail. Now, you mentioned clinical correlations. This is amazing.
Yeah.
The abundance map, the one measuring protein levels, it actually showed significant correlations with real-world patient outcomes.
Yeah, this was striking. The scores from the abundance map correlated significantly with disease duration in SOD1 ALS patients. The R value was 0.34.
Okay.
And also with age of ALS onset, with an R value of 0.22.
Now, help us interpret those R values, 0.34, 0.22. How significant is that in a complex disease like ALS? Is that a strong link?
That's a great question. In the context of complex, multifactorial diseases like ALS, where so many things influence progression, genetics, environment, who knows what else, R values like 0.34 and 0.22 are actually remarkably strong signals.
Really?
Yes. It means that even with all the other noise and variability, the amount of stable SOD1 protein measured in this assay is a quantifiable, significant predictor of how long the disease might last and when it might start. It's a tangible link between that molecular measurement and the clinical reality for patients.
So it's moving towards prediction based on genotype.
It's a definite step in that direction. And maybe the most immediately impactful finding for clinical practice is how well that abundance map performed in classifying whether a variant is pathogenic, you know, disease-causing.
Epidemiologic tools.
Significantly better. It outperformed four widely used computational predictors, things like alpha-missense and CPT. They used a metric called AUBPRC.
The area under the balanced precision recall curve.
Right. Bit of a mouthful, but it's a good way to measure accuracy, especially when dealing with imbalanced data like rare disease variants versus common benign ones. The abundance map achieved a much higher AUBPRC, around 0.79 to 0.80.
Which means it's better at correctly identifying the truly problematic variants.
Exactly. More sensitive and more specific, particularly for those rarer variants that are clinically critical.
Which brings us right back to that aha moment for those frustrating VUSs, the variants of uncertain significance.
Yes. This is where the map really shines. The abundance map provided new, strong functional evidence for a remarkable 41% of the SOD1 VUSs currently listed in ClinVar.
41%? That's huge.
It is. It meant they could confidently reclassify 10 of those VUSs as likely benign and 7 as pathogenic, providing actual answers where there were none before.
Answers that doctors and patients desperately need.
Absolutely. And maybe even more astonishingly, it provided crucial functional evidence for 55% of missense variants that haven't even been seen in the clinic yet.
Wow. So getting ahead of the curve.
Totally. Imagine getting functional data on a variant before the first patient with it even walks into a clinic. That's genuinely predictive medicine in action.
So let's pull this together. What does all this mean for patients, right now and in the near future?
Well, the immediate impact is clear. This deep dive provides robust functional evidence that can directly help clinicians interpret SOD1 variants for someone currently stuck with a VUS result.
In that limbo.
Exactly. This evidence could be the key to confirming an early ALS diagnosis that allows earlier access to specific, tailored therapies like the antisense oligonucleotides that target SOD1.
Which could potentially slow things down.
That's the hope. It's about shortening that agonizing diagnostic wait and getting people the help they need faster, potentially before too much irreversible motor neuron damage occurs. It's a profound shift.
And the impact seems broader than just the individual patient.
Definitely. These comprehensive maps make cascade screening much more informative. That's testing family members who might be carriers.
So they can get genetic counseling, maybe surveillance.
Precisely. And think about compound heterozygotes people who inherit two different faulty SOD1 variants, one from each parent. Knowing the specific functional impact of both variants is critical for guiding treatment decisions. It offers a much clearer path for whole families.
And stepping back even further, what's the bigger picture significance here, beyond SOD1, beyond ALS?
Well, these variant effect maps, they're not just about SOD1. The methodology, the data itself, it serves as a rich resource for understanding fundamental rules, how sequence links to structure, and how structure links to function in proteins generally.
Like building a bigger library of protein knowledge.
Exactly. It contributes to this growing atlas of variant effects. Every map like this we build for one gene adds to our overall understanding, potentially giving us tools and insights we can apply to many other disease genes across a whole range of genetic conditions.
Of course, you always have to talk about limitations. No study is perfect, but researchers acknowledge some caveats, right?
They did, very transparently. One issue is the lack of officially classified, truly benign SOD1 variants in public databases. They had to use proxy benign variants, common variants assumed to be okay.
How much does that weaken the conclusions, do you think, using proxies?
It's a fair point. Using proxies introduces a slight uncertainty, naturally. You'd always prefer definitively benign variants as your baseline. However, given the rigor of their experiments, the sheer number of variants they tested, and especially the strong correlations they found with actual clinical data.
It suggests the findings are pretty solid despite that.
I think so, yes. It makes their classifications likely very robust. But it does highlight an ongoing need for better curation, better annotation in our public genetic databases. We need more confirmed benign variants listed.
Okay. And they also mentioned the yeast model isn't perfect human physiology.
Right. Differences between yeast cells and human neurons are real. Plus, these specific maps don't directly measure protein aggregation clumping, which we know is another important way SOD1 can cause disease.
So it's a piece of the puzzle, a very important piece, but not the whole picture yet.
Exactly. It shows we're always learning, always refining. No single model or assay captures everything. This raises really important next questions, doesn't it?
Like what?
Like, how will expert panels, groups like Klingon, formally integrate these comprehensive maps into clinical practice guidelines? How do we make the standard of care?
And how do we build on this?
Right. How can future studies maybe add more scalable assays, perhaps ones that do measure aggregation or other complex mechanisms like prion-like propagation? And how do we best validate all this in more complex models like patient-derived neurons?
It feels like this work opens up a lot of new doors.
It really does. It's foundational. We're just beginning to understand disease truly at the base-by-base level.
So wrapping up, this deep dive has really shown us how comprehensive functional mapping of SOD1 variants is fundamentally changing our ability to understand, diagnose, and hopefully treat ALS more effectively.
Yeah, by finally resolving so many of those variants of uncertain significance and clearly linking specific genetic changes to the actual disease course, this research provides a powerful, practical tool for personalized medicine. It's making it a reality, not just a far-off concept.
So the final thought for our listeners, what does this success story for SOD1 mean for accelerating diagnosis and developing highly targeted therapies for other complex genetic diseases, especially those where ambiguous genetic results are currently creating huge barriers for patients and their families? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoy this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.